everybody, I'm Craig Eastman, and as always, I'm coming to you from the banks of the sunny River Mersey, and as a special treat in the room with me today are Scott Morris.
Hello.
And Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
All in one location, what more could you ask for? We're going to have a brief discussion today about The X-Files, I Want to Believe, Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, Starship Troopers 3, Star Wars The Clone Wars, The Love Guru, Elite Squad and CJ7. So without further ado, we'll batter on. It's been a few years since the last X-Files film, and I was never a huge fan of the series in the first place anyway, but some level of hope seems to have been pinned on the performance of X-Files I Want to Believe in cinemas. But after such a long hiatus, is there any steam left to propel it into the popular conscience, Scott?
Sadly, no. It is a series which eventually collapsed under the weight of its own mythology, and by the end of the series 9 you had Mulder on the run from the, well, having been convicted of murder of a supposed super agent or some such nonsense, he was supposed to be running for his life, and so it's a bit of a surprise when you start this film and you find him sitting in a cottage in the middle of a field somewhere. But apparently he didn't look that hard for them. So this film has eventually taken what's happened in the last few series of The X-Files and ignored it completely because no one watched it. So, which is fair enough. It starts off with Mulder being called back into the FBI to investigate what is essentially a missing persons case. So an FBI agent has gone AWOL. The thing that makes this an X-File is that the only hint seems to be coming from a convicted paedophile ex-priest, Father Joe, played by Billy Connolly, who is providing them with psychic insights as to where the victim is and what's going on with that. What follows is essentially a more or less standard police procedural with the odd bit where Billy Connolly's eyes start to bleed for no particularly good reason. It's not... The main problem with The X-Files, this movie, is that it's really not odd enough to be an X-Files movie. If you're going to go back to a series after this long, you've got to have aliens up the wazoo and all sorts of things. This appears to be a film that is watchable to people who haven't seen any of the series and can't quite remember what
it
is.
From what I've heard, it's a serial killer film, essentially,
yeah,
isn't it?
It largely feels like it should be Morgan Freeman playing Alex Cross or something like that, rather than anything to do with The X-Files at all.
It really does feel like a sort of rejected fourth series filler script rather than something that's worthy of having a movie experience of its own.
Bizarrely odd choice. Do David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson slip back into their roles easily enough?
Yeah, to the most part. They're always fairly comfortable with it.
There's the old chemistry there.
I suppose they're not really given anything to do. None of it's interesting enough. That it's not much more than Gillian Anderson's typical anguish as Scully over religion and the job at the FBI and Mulder just being Mulder.
So why have they chosen then to wheel back out of the cupboard something which is so obviously lacklustre? Is it part of some grander scheme for the X-Files franchise? Or?
I don't believe so, and certainly the way it's performed, I'm guessing not. This film felt a lot like a television series extended by putting in completely meaningless bits. There's entire subplots that add nothing to anything and could easily have been cut out and produced to some kind of mini-series length. I think this would have been far more comfortable if they'd done a small mini-series.
Rather tersely, heard some interviews with Chris Carter recently where he said it's worthwhile fans of the series sitting through the credits to the surprise sequence at the end, which he thinks will be of some interest to them. Is that true?
I didn't sit through the credits, so I have no idea.
Ah. Well, it certainly wasn't interesting enough to have a sit through credits for it.
Excellent. Perhaps if you want people to sit through the credits and see an end bit, you might want to make it interesting enough for them to sit through the film.
You could have had tap dancing hippos at the end sequence and it still wouldn't have been good enough to save the rest of the film.
And
so,
even then, I sort of very much dislike things being added at the end of end credits because nobody stays the end credits unless you flag it very, very prominently, stay to the end credits. And also, well, why bother putting at the end of the end credits if it's that important?
Yeah.
At the end of X-Men 3.
And there's a few little nice nod backs to the series for the fans, but then again, the rest of the film isn't a particularly good nod back to the fans. So what the point of it was in the grand scheme of things, I'm not sure. It's not a terrible movie. It's just a bit bland.
Pointless.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just doesn't feel like it should have the X-Files name on it.
There we go. Pointless extension of an already waning brand. Surely the same thing couldn't be said of The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. After making such a good job of The Mummy Returns that it pretty much whipped the carpet out from under his feet, director Stephen Sommers is nowhere to be seen in this instalment. Instead, it's being directed by Rob Cohen. Drew, The Mummy Returns was a great big festering pile of horse cack. Is Tomb of the Dragon Emperor any better?
Well, after having seen The Mummy, I didn't dare watch The Mummy Returns because the original one was also a big pile of festering horse cack.
It was fun in places.
It was fun where it was a different film when I took the DVD out of the player and put something else in instead, yes.
Oh, okay.
Sadly, The Mummy 3, and I was thinking, ah, another Mummy film, just what the world was crying out for. Though the appropriate result after the original The Mummy was released would have been some sort of prison sentence for Stephen Sommers. at least then he might not have been able to visit upon the world the travesty that was Van Helsing. Instead, there was a sequel, a spin-off for the Scorpion King Craig alluded to, for those fortunate enough to have been unaware of such things, and now a second sequel. The only glimmer of light here is that Stephen Sommers has vacated the director's seat and become producer instead, meaning the possibility of someone with even the vaguest degree of competence in a director's chair, though given it's the director of XXX, I wouldn't hold out too much hope.
No.
The Mummy 3 sees Jet Li and Michelle Yeoh in a film about the police being set up by internal affairs, though the police were aware of this from the beginning. Well, actually they didn't, but taking a leaf from Homer Simpson's book, this is a film I watched in my head during the seemingly interminable and utterly unnecessary prologue. Some of it did filter through, though, you know, enough to assure me that the entire opening could have been dispensed with and replaced by a single sentence or two at a push. It seems that the legendary Dragon Emperor, a powerful and magical ancient Chinese emperor,
is there another kind?
has been turned to stone by Michelle Yeoh's curse, and he and his entire army are now buried beneath tons of sand, waiting to be awoken with the appropriate magical artifact. Meanwhile, as Rick O'Connell, played by Brendan Fraser, and his wife Evelyn, Maria Bello replacing Rachel Weisz, having survived their roles as special agents during World War II, try to fill their time in their Oxfordshire home in various tedious non-mummy bashing ways, and their offspring Alex is on the other side of the world digging up ancient cities and being manipulated into resurrecting the Dragon Emperor. His parents are also dragged into it in a massively convoluted manner, and suddenly their lives, though threatened, are that much more fun as they're back fighting mummies. The acting performances are pretty poor, and once again, this is the biggest problem for this film, it's a case of Jet Li being utterly wasted. After the brief glimmer of hope that was The Forbidden Kingdom, where Jet Li even got to smile for a change in American film, he's back to being sullen, and in this film doesn't even get to make use of his martial arts talents, as mostly he's there as a reference point for the CGI artists.
Yay!
And again, that's really the crux of it. It's yet another film which boils down to a metric fuckton of CGI characters battering seven bells out of another metric fuckton of CGI characters, with all the attendant disinterest that that brings. Now, the best I can say about this film is that I don't really have much bad to say about it. I expected to hate it, but didn't. It's certainly nowhere near as awful as the first Mummy film, which really isn't saying much, I know, but for the most part it was mildly entertained, though not enough for me to actually bother recommending it to anyone.
Good grief, Scott.
Pretty much what you'd expect from the third outing of a film which is a third-rate knockoff of Indiana Jones in the first place. It's bland, it's inoffensive, it's empty calories, it's a film you can watch without ruining your appetite for a proper film. It's the sort of thing you sit down and watch and you're gonna wonder why it even exists in the first place, but seeing as it's on screen, it's all right enough to get through without making you want to saw your eyeballs off. I concede if you've got small children that you need to keep occupied, that's probably a reasonable enough way to do it. It's probably more appropriate than Dark Knight was, although of course Dark Knight is an exponentially better film.
I found I had no beef. In fact, I got on reasonably well with The Scorpion King, as it turns out. I thought it was quite a fun little romp. Does this compare, in what sense does this compare to that, more favourably or less?
Badly, if memory serves, because pretty much everything that happens in this film is just CG battering other CG about, and there's not a lot of interesting action.
The Scorpion King, apart from the apparently obligatory comedy sidekick that was in it, was reasonably fun in a sort of way that sort of middling Arnold Schwarzenegger films are. So it's definitely fares worse than that, and you're not going to have gone into cinema or sat down to rent and watch it and think, I've wasted my time, but you're never going to find it worthwhile to deliberately seek out and do.
Yeah, I feel like you've got your whole
£7 out of it.
Well, it's one of those films you walk out and go, yeah, and then you'll never think of it again unless you're perhaps recording a podcast about it.
What with this and Journey to the Centre of the Earth, Brendan Fraser seems to be stuck in sort of substandard diet Harrison Ford Saturday matinee idol territory now, isn't he? I remember watching Gods and Monsters and thinking, oh my goodness, Brendan Fraser can really, really act. And since then, he's not really had much of a chance again.
Yeah, well, back in the mists of time, we covered The Quiet American, which was one of the earliest reviews on the site, and he's very good in that.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
since then, he's just been going, oh, wah, and pointing at CG things.
He doesn't have a big part, but he has a DA air call in Crash, so he's had some parts in worthy films, and again, there were so many characters in that he never had much of a chance to stretch himself, but I mean, he does still manage to get cast in decent stuff, but it just ends up in this tripe all the time.
If someone put a gun to your head and said X-Files or Mummy, which would it be?
The gun.
There we go. Starship Troopers 3, unusually for the podcast, is not a cinema release. It's a straight-to-video sequel to a sequel, but we've decided to review it anyway. It doesn't follow on logically from the plot of either of the two previous films. It certainly doesn't have the production values of the first. But, Scott, what is the basic premise?
The essential premise of this film is to fleece money out of people who still have any affection for Starship Troopers in the first place.
Yay!
I would imagine the Starship Troopers, of course, is a fantastic film which everyone loves because it's great, and if you need an explanation of that, then just stop listening because you're not our kind of people at all. Starship Troopers 2 was quite clearly a film which had nothing whatsoever to do with Starship Troopers and just got a hold of the franchise at the last minute and hastily had references to the Federation duly rigged into it, and it was god awful. So I'm kind of surprised it's made it to 3, but with 3 at least it does feel a lot more like a continuation of the first film. It has the same kind of visual style, it's the same over-the-top
violence. I was pleasantly surprised, actually. In places the production value dipped quite drastically.
Yes.
But by and large there was some halfway decent CG in there, and the look and feel of it was in keeping with the first film.
Yeah, what it essentially revolves into is a returning Casper Van Dien. He returns as Johnny Rico, who is eventually, after a bit of fanning about, has to rescue the Sky Marshal Anoki, the leader of the Federation, who also has a nifty line in producing CDs for some reason, of how patriotic it is to die for your country. He is called in to get in a big stompy-powered exoskeleton suit with a small army of goons and go and rescue him from some big CG monster doodad in the way that this thing normally happens. What can you say about this film? It's there, and that's about it. The CG is okay in some places, in some cases looks absolutely god-awful.
There are moments we've discussed as one point where one of the scorpions attacks and sort of on the approach to the compound, you get a nice view of the scorpion, sort of rendered in halfway decent CG, yeah. And then it knocks down the wall, and it's just this tail poking over the wall, and it's so quite clearly three guys with ropes sort of pulling this big fabric thing back and forward. But I was most pleasantly surprised by the way in which it managed to retain at least some of the humour of the first film. There was a fairly decent stab at that sort of sly sense of getting digs in at the media and whatnot. I particularly like the televised hangings.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few bits of it. Well, stylistically, it does feel a lot like it, all these little media breaks and that. It does feel sort of like an artist's impression of what the first film was like, but there are moments that are quite good. There's some attempt at the kind of social commentary where it starts bringing up religion halfway through it, which was beginning to annoy me until they sort of threw a rope-a-dope at you in the last frame and sort of started using it as a cultural control rather than anything sort of hopeful and good, which I thought, okay, I'll appreciate that a little bit, but it still felt a little bit forced into what is essentially a very hokey science fiction setup in the first place. It's a story that is worthy of Star Trek Voyager or something along those lines.
That's a brutal thing, isn't it?
It is sort of mildly entertaining as long as you like the first film, but I mean, your target audience for this film is people that liked the first one and weren't too scared off by the second one, which seems an odd thing to actually start making films so slender a margin. I can't see this appealing to anyone new outside the franchise.
When you consider it's a straight-to-video, a second sequel, I think it's probably a lot better than you have any right to expect. I wonder if it has anything to do with the fact that Paul Verhoeven's listed as executive producer, whether that means he's just stuck some cash into it, or if he's actually had any hand in overseeing the sort of the production design or anything
or
like that.
Or perhaps just solely because he's an investment in the rights from the first film.
Yeah, could well be.
Anyway, so the only real thing that bothered me about this film was Casper Van Dien trying to do an impersonation of Michael Ironside all the way throughout it, which only made me think, I want Michael Ironside here instead rather than him.
Exactly. Oh, there you go. I wouldn't necessarily recommend anybody to rent it or actively seek it out, but if it's on TV one rainy afternoon, I would say it's worth having a gander at, if only for the chuckle factor. Star Wars The Clone Wars is the first return back to the Star Wars universe that wasn't going to happen ever again anyway, until George Lucas decided he needed, some more logs for the fire. This time rendered in child-friendly CG. Scott, fill us in.
This follows on from the Clone Wars anime in a sort of Nickelodeon sense that was done before Attack of the Clones came out, which was pretty dire, to be honest, and really not worth seeking out at all. This is changing to a three-dimensional stylized rendering for a Nuka television series, which is coming up, which is, in many ways, most of the problems of this film stem from the fact that it's episode zero of a television series rather than a film itself.
Setting up a TV franchise, yeah.
Roughly what happens, the Galactic Alliance are having trouble getting their shipping lanes and sorted out because they're in the middle of a massive war. As such, when Jabba the Hutt's son is kidnapped, it seems an opportunity for them to help him out, which will in turn allow them to use Jabba the Hutt's space lanes, which he's been controlling the Outer Rim for. So there is some semblance of reason why they're going to helping an evil person. You have Obi-Wan, who is in this film voiced by James Arnold Taylor, who has the uncomfortable job of impersonating Ewan McGregor impersonating Alec Guinness, which works about as well as you'd expect. So Obi-Wan, Anakin, and Anakin's new Padawan learner, Ahsoka, are dispatched to reclaim Jabba's son. And meanwhile, Count Dooku and his new apprentice, referred to as Ventress, I believe, is sent out to try and stop them, manipulate the events, and try and do the usual sort of bad guy things. It's easy to dismiss it, and everyone seems to have dismissed it, because everyone's making the same joke of, ha, finally George Lucas has managed to make a Star Wars film that does not have any humans in it, ha, 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 because he's been doing that for a while now. Now, okay, if you're going to say that, then you've got to go back and say, aren't all Pixar films terrible because they don't have trained fish like in Finding Nemo? It's a stupid criticism and I don't like it at all. But there's plenty of things that you can get upset by in this film. It does the usual Star Wars thing of just introducing a secondary villain, like they did with Darth Maul, like they did with General Grievous, like they did pretty much with Count Dooku as well, and just having like, this is the new evil guy, care about him please. And I couldn't be bothered with that in any of the other ones, and I can't be bothered with it now. I mean, all of those, Count Dooku kind of gets away with it because it's Christopher Lee.
The others are just cheap diversions, yeah.
Yeah, so Ventress in this is essentially another jumping action doll. It's, there's a lot of fairly forced conversation between Anakin and his new learner, because that's presumably going to the basis of the series going forward, their slightly strained relationship. But despite that, it's not entirely dismissible. It's at least fun for the most part. It actually, most of the action feels a lot more like Star Wars, the old proper Star Wars films, than much of the new ones. And that's about the only thing I can really think of it that's good. The rest of it, it does feel a lot like filler material again. It's largely set up to introduce new characters and make you care about them a little bit and then get you to watch the television series, which is about to start. And that's where, that's its main flaw. That's its downfall.
I'm assuming it's just been rendered in a single big batch with the TV series, because the one thing I can say about it, having not seen any of it, I have, you know, doesn't normally stop me from commenting anyway, is that the quality of the rendering doesn't seem particularly up to scratch for a cinema release. It seems a little bit basic.
It's, I wouldn't say it's basic so much as it's just, it just has a very strange style, which takes a little bit of getting used to. And I saw the trailers and thought it looked terrible, but when you actually sit down and watch it, it makes more sense when you're seeing a lot of it together rather than just little bits and bobs. And it's okay. It's handled the action sequences of lightsabers flashing about all right as well. I've no real complaints with it. I suspect if it was trying to keep children amused, they'd rather go and see this than The Mummy Returns.
Key question is, having watched this, are you going to have any interest in the TV series?
Well, that's the thing. Personally, no. It's certainly not good enough to warrant working out where it's getting shown and getting a hold of it. It's not bad, but certainly it's not really whetted my appetite for a whole series full of it anyway.
Drew, like me, you haven't seen it. Get your two pence in.
Clearly it is Boz. No, like, the original TV series didn't interest me at all, and I grew up with Star Wars and loved it. And I'm just so disappointed with all the prequels that I just don't want to watch any Star Wars anymore.
I found myself, I did go back to Star Wars, the original proper Star Wars, A New Hope, as it was suddenly retitled. I don't actually like it that much anymore. I'm not sure if it's just because it wasn't that great in the first place, because let's be honest, it's a bit ropey. It kind of gets away with it because it seems a lot of fun, but now the sort of cloud of nostalgia has been dispelled by all these new stuff. And sit down and watch it and go, well, if I'm actually looking at this critically, it's kind of Boz.
That's the sum total of what George Lucas has achieved, that he set out with something that would have remained iconic had he just not tampered with it so frequently and to such a horrendously bab quality. Had he been more interested in preserving his IP rather than prostituting it out to toy manufacturers, then it might be a different story. But the reason why I can't be bothered going to see the Clone Wars is because I can't be bothered with Star Wars full stop anymore.
As I said, I'm just so disappointed with the whole Star Wars everything now. And it'd be nice if you could sort of go and sit down and watch Star Wars with your brain set to 7-year-old. In which case I would love it, because I used to watch it all the time. Once we had all the toys, I loved it. It's just been ruined for me.
We've said it before, we've said it again. Fuck off, George.
Write in for your t-shirts now.
Yes, no one's written in for a t-shirt yet, as I promised, what, 3 podcasts ago now? I can't remember. No one's emailed us yet. podcast@theoneliner.com. This month also saw the return to cinema screens of Mike Myers with his new comedy. Well, I call it an idea, but I use the term loosely. His new character, the love guru, Guru Pitka, an American raised in India as a guru under the tutelage of Ben Kingsley, or Guru Tuggenmapuda, or something like that, as his name is. One of many terse, hard-to-decipher jokes. Guru Pitka dreams of nothing more than becoming bigger than Deepak Chopra, and the way he's going to do this is by getting a slot on Oprah. The way in which he's going to get a slot on Oprah is by getting Darren Roanoke, the famous hockey player, back with his estranged wife so that his team can win some cup or another. If that sounds protracted and terse, that's because it is. Drew, what's the sum total then of The Love Guru?
The sum total is not very much above zero, unfortunately. For a long time in my eyes, Mike Myers could do no wrong. From Wayne's World right through to So Married and Axe Murdered into the second Austin Powers, everything he did seemed to be touched with gold, and I loved all of it. And then he did Goldmember. And Goldmember, for those who've seen it, was mildly amusing in places, but just so much less fun than the other Austin Powers films, it may as well not have been there. Then he did the Shrek films, which were funny, but there's only live-action thing of late that I recall was The Cat in the Hat. That was rubbish, and he's carried on to do The Love Guru, and it's terrible and tawdry and dire and not at all funny. Although they're very much strained in The Love Guru, a lot of the jokes and silly puerile stuff is the same sort of jokes that are in Austin Powers, and I did wonder whether perhaps part of why I wasn't finding it at all funny was because it was the same sort of jokes that were in some of the Austin Powers films, but then I went and watched Austin Powers again and still laughed. So he somehow lost the key of making it funny, and it just seemed stretched and strained and trying far too hard.
For a character that he says he's been doing for as long as Austin Powers in his sort of stand-up shows occasionally, you'd think he'd have worked out a little bit more material for it at this point. It does feel like his C-grade material. If this was a half-hour show or something, I'd probably have found it quite funny. Like, there's little bits like his constant references to his books that he's produced in the past, like, I know you are, but what am I? Actually, I kind of chuckled at those, but yeah. It's just surrounded by so much padding and filler and things that just simply aren't funny.
Somehow they've even managed to waste Stephen Colbert in, who I'm a great fan of, as a sports commentator, and he may as well not be there. And the only thing that was in any way reasonably funny was somebody who wasn't Mike Myers, another bloke they brought in off of The Daily Show.
Yeah.
Even things like there's a scene where Mike Myers has replaced his beard with candy floss, and probably in any other film that would have cracked me up. It's just so incredibly silly, and I love that stuff, but just and this in set in so much surrounding dross, it was just all at sea, and even that couldn't make me laugh in this film.
I can't share your enthusiasm for all of Myers' previous work, because I've always found him to have a tendency to be a bit overindulgent at times, and just when you think he's being really funny, he just takes it too far and does things that he thinks are funny, which frankly aren't. But I have liked the majority of his output, but the problem with this film, as far as I see it, is it's directed by a fella called Marco Schnabel. I think he was second unit director or something like that in the Austin Powers films. Clearly, he doesn't have the balls yet to tell Mike Myers when he's not being funny. And the whole film is just Mike Myers not being funny and no one having the courage to say, Mike, that's not funny. That's the problem I see with it. The only person who I found, well, I tell a lie, there were two people in the film who made me chuckle more than twice. And one of them was Ben Kingsley, which I never thought I'd hear myself say. And the other one was Justin Timberlake, who, say what you like, at least the man doesn't mind taking the absolute piss out of himself.
That's nice. I wouldn't agree with the Ben Kingsley bit, though. I found those some of the most irritating parts of the film.
I don't know. I found a lot of things a lot more irritating than him in it.
I'm really beginning to wish people would stop casting Jessica Alba in anything. She's very pretty, but she has all the screen presence of a cardboard cutout of herself. Yeah. It would probably be cheaper.
I don't know about you guys, but the single biggest laugh I got was the outtake at the very end, which wasn't even part of the film. That made me giggle, and that was about it. And when an outtake is your single biggest laugh, then you've clearly got a big, big problem. So I don't imagine we'll be seeing a sequel to The Love Guru anytime soon.
What, you're not desperate for another 90 minutes of that accent being the only joke?
The ever accurate user rating on IMDb currently suggests 3.6 out of 10, which for once is actually quite accurate. Never mind, never mind. You'll get another shot at something. He's not short of a bob or two, is he? So it's not like he's depending on the Love Guru for his retirement fund. Ah, now, Elite Squad's been garnering some praise. It's a Brazilian film, am I correct, Scott?
Yes.
Which is set in the favelas and deals with a period in which, I believe it's based on a true story. Prior to a papal visit to the favelas of Brazil, the police are tasked with understandably clearing the place up a bit beforehand. Enter the titular Elite Squad. Scott, what would be the premise?
Well, the most interesting thing, I mean, everyone's been saying it, it's hung together as the Pope visit has all of these implications, and it actually doesn't. It's mentioned a couple of times, and it seems to be entirely irrelevant to what's going on in the rest of it. It's really looking at corruption in the Brazilian police force and the state of the favelas, which has been adequately explored in A City of God and more recently City of Men. It is set around the captain of the Elite Squad, played by Captain Nascimento, who is starting to suffer from stress due to the fact that he's continually in wars with drug dealers for pretty much his entire life, and he's decided to try and find a couple of replacements for him. Two obvious ones are young policemen Neto and Andre, who are two old friends and two rare straight policemen.
We should say that straight as in not corrupt.
Yes.
We're not suggesting that the entire Brazilian police force is homosexual.
No, although if this film is anything to go by, the Brazilian police force is about as corrupt as Chicago back in 1930s before Elliot Ness got his way. Everyone's on the take, everyone is stealing bits of kit for their own car, and the police cars are going unmaintained and all that sort of thing. So these two guys are trying to clean it up, and as part of that they join the Elite Squad. And essentially what you get is a fairly long explanation of the quite scary cult kind of initiations that it takes to get into Elite Squad. Their training thing is more like torture in any other society. So basically that is happening, and at the same time one of the policemen is trying to maintain his relationship with a idealistic young girl in the ghettos who's falling in with some of the drug dealers as well. So obviously that's going to give you a bit of drama there. So the problem I've got with this film is really just the fact that it is told in an entirely disjointed style with a voiceover by Captain Nascimento all the way throughout it. And it doesn't add a damn thing to the thing. It's essentially he's saying what is happening on the screen, and it's a very stupid thing to do. I've never seen a film with a voiceover which wouldn't be made better by taking the voiceover out of it.
Yeah.
And that's probably the case here. I mean, he's not saying anything particularly deep and insightful. He's just saying, and so there are these two people, and then it shows you these two people. So, well, why bother? You know, show, don't tell. Other than that, it's a decent enough film. It's probably not really doing anything that we've not seen before and seen fairly recently, and the simple fact that it's in Portuguese does not make it better. I'm surprised to see it won the Golden Bear Berlin.
Does it deserve any of the awards praise it's been garnering?
It's a good film. I mean, it's certainly the best film we'll talk about here today, and it's worth watching. It's not what I would immediately categorise as being worthy of an award. I don't know if it is just because it does seem like it's a very different film that we normally find in festivals. It is quite violent. There's a lot of fairly nasty things going on in this film, and it's quite effectively done. Some nice shootouts, and the aftermath of that's handled quite well. It's certainly different from the usual festival fare, but it's certainly not good enough to warrant any of the sort of award, and it feels a lot like City of God crossed with Dark. And it's certainly not bad, but again, the only thing that was really got to say that's annoying me about this film is the voiceover, which was sort of pushing you away from the film rather than enveloping you in it. Other than that, it's a decent film and it's very worth seeing, but I'm not convinced by the best film ever hype for it.
Alright then, there we go. So it's probably the best thing, well, it's definitely the best thing that we're talking about this week. If you have to check something out, check it out. But where in our list of priorities to see this week would CJ7, the new Stephen Chow film, come, Drew?
That question is best answered when you find out what age the person asking it is.
Right.
Because if you're about, I don't know, primary school age, or 7 or 8 perhaps, then it's probably the top choice.
Excellent.
Assuming you're Chinese, because I'm not sure how many British 7 or 8-year-olds want to read subtitles.
And you're not the 7 or 8-year-old who looks old enough to get into see Elite Squad.
Yes. As an adult, if you like Stephen Chow, then it's something to perhaps look for at some point, but I wouldn't hurry out to get it, and there are better things to see at the moment. It's a strange little film, but quite amusing and entertaining. It involves a young boy who lives with his labourer father, and they live in squalor, really, but his father works very, very hard to get as much money as he can to send his son to a top school an area of China where they live. But he's bullied at school, and understandably, he has a child jealous of the kids who have the flashy toys around them, particularly one little Aibo dog knockoff called CG1 that the creepy bully in his class has and taunts him with. So,
how can you taunt someone with a creepy Aibo knockoff?
To be honest, that bully was...
That's China.
I was happy being bullied by that guy. He was quite imaginative. Like, it doesn't matter how much you eat, you'll always be doomed to be a dwarf. I wouldn't mind being bullied if they were constantly that funny.
So he tells his father that he wants this dog, and his father obviously unable to provide it for him, but is more bothered about him getting a good education. But finds this strange rubber ball one day on the rubbish dump where he gets a lot of other things for his house and his son, which after some playing about with, despite looking like a big lump of green rubber, turns out to be an alien in the way of these things.
As you do.
And this alien becomes a friend to the young boy. The son, Dickie, becomes friends with his alien super dog. And what follows is something of a cross between E.T., batteries not included, as it does go around repairing things, and perhaps the Mogwai part of Gremlins, and certainly the sound design for the creature is stolen wholesale from Gremlins.
Yeah.
And the rest is reasonably predictable, but fairly entertaining. The boy learns to appreciate the toy alien dog thing for what it is, and eventually develops friends at school. None of this is spot in the plot, it's nothing revolutionary. What point is just the interaction between the boy and the CGI dog.
The key question I have to ask about this film, does Stephen Chow kick anyone hard in the face?
No.
No.
Aww. So is there actually any point to Stephen Chow's casting in this film?
Well, there is something to be said for an intergalactic space dog that fires out jobbies like a Bren gun.
Nice.
There are some amusing bits, and certainly a seven-year-old's going to appreciate that, I'm quite sure. Yeah.
There's a few nods to Shaolin and Soccer and his other films, and certainly that. The little bully kid has been made up to look exactly like one of the guys that's in the other two films. You know, looking at the bald fella who was his second fiddle in Shaolin and Soccer and all that kind of guy.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's made up to look exactly like him. So there's a few little nods to sort of Stephen Chow fans. It's full of his endearingly shonky CG work. But certainly if you're over seven, then there's probably not any point watching the film at all, and there's not really anything for us in it. But it's kind of enjoyable enough as it is.
It was kind of, when the character they've created, it's like it could have been horribly schmaltzy, but it's more just kind of cute and endearing to a point where it doesn't bother me, which is quite nice. But yeah, as an adult, as I was saying, there's not much to it. But again, it's none of those films, unfortunately. It's not, there is a dubbed version available, whether that would reach a cinema, I don't know. And I tend to avoid them like the plague. But if there were a dubbed version, then your kids might get something out of it, and you wouldn't feel gypped having to sit through it.
We're in that awkward position of being old enough to sort of be detached from that kind of thing now, and yet not have children ourselves, where we might see whether or not kids appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't see kids liking this unless they can speak either Mandarin or Cantonese.
No. I imagine younger kids will struggle with it subtitles.
The kids aren't going to read that, as I was saying earlier, but if there is a dub available, perhaps on DVD if there's a dub, if you perhaps leave the room and you've got kids and you can let them watch the dubbed version because they don't know any better yet.
Yeah. Well, there you go. If any of you have a dubbed version that your kids have watched and enjoyed, let us know. Before we finish, I'd just like to say my nomination for creepiest movie moment this month goes to Mike Myers' head pasted on that child's body in the Love Guru. I made the mistake of watching it in my bed one night. I won't tell you about the nightmares. Thanks for listening as always, guys, and we'll be back again to talk about some other stuff soon. But in the meantime, I've been Craig, and Scott was Scott.
Take care, guys.
And Drew was unusually Drew.
Adieu.
Nice. And the way he's going to get in Slopra, get a slot on Oprah. That's a slot on Oprah. I'm evolving a more efficient form of speech.